Why are women surviving the coronavirus at much higher rates than men? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Men are dying at double the rate of women from COVID-19. New research from FIU explores some of the reasons why and which women remain the most vulnerable. Plus, lawmakers are set to meet in Tallahassee this week. A year into the pandemic, the state faces grave health, economic, and educational challenges. On top of COVID, the legislature has ambitious environmental plans. We're going to hear from two Republican state lawmakers in Palm Beach and Broward counties, and we'll take your questions. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Men are dying of COVID-19 at double the rate of women. Women's hormones seem to be helping in the battle against the virus. A new paper from Florida International University looks into this difference, and it also found that not all women are equally protected. Allison Roach is one of the co-authors of the study. She will be graduating from medical school at FIU this year, and she joins us now. Allison, great to have you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Dr. Judette Louis. She is the chair of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of South Florida and the president of the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine. Dr. Louis, it is such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Louis, I want to start with you. You know, in the past, and even till this day, science sometimes leaves out minorities and vulnerable populations in their research. And I'm wondering, with COVID-19, why can't you just study one group of people and it's just one size fits all across the board, it'll work? Why do you have to break it up and look at different groups?
You absolutely have to do that because people are different and things, and you know, we have a lot of history of this where things that we thought would translate to everyone, we found there were different nuances. During the study phase, something that appeared to be very effective, that when you go to implement it, there might be different ways in which the body reacts to some of these medications or treatments that then renders it less effective. And so anytime you're studying any kind of intervention, you really want to make sure that the group that you're trying to intervene is represented in the group that you're studying.
And of course, when you're looking at men and women, you're talking about different types of hormones. So they are, you know, they don't share a lot of things. There are a lot of differences between the two. Allison, what and where did you find why more men are dying of COVID-19 than women? How did you come across this?
So we looked at data from various countries and noticed that there was a sex difference in mortality, specifically men dying more than women in most countries. And one of the theories that we proposed in our literature review was the fact that men have more androgens compared to women, and women have hormones like estrogen and progesterone that may be more protective in coronavirus disease.
And the androgens, just to, for those of us who are not doctors, remind us of what, so what was the androgen and what is it doing?
So androgen, one type of commonly known androgen is testosterone. And so specifically in coronavirus disease, there are two receptors that are responsible for viral entry. One of these receptors is called the type 2 transmembrane serine protease, and it's androgen regulated. And what that means is for someone who has more androgens in their body, they may be more susceptible to viral entry from COVID-19.
So the testosterone that I possess might actually be helping the COVID-19 more easily infect me than the estrogen that you have that may be protecting you.
Correct.
Is that simple? Okay. And Allison, you found some women are still more susceptible. You found that women in three different categories had higher mortality rates and higher risk for complications of COVID-19. Why?
So we looked at specifically women who are pregnant, women in the menopausal category, and possibly women with a condition known as polycystic ovarian syndrome. So in pregnancy, there are various physiologic changes that occur that predispose a woman's risk for severe COVID infection. Some of the physiologic changes include airway edema. They may have an elevated diaphragm and they require more oxygen consumption and an overall immunocompromised state. In addition, in pregnancy, the patients also have increased expression of the ACE2 receptor, which is implicated in viral infection. And another thing that we looked at in pregnancy was the fact that in the postpartum period, we were hypothesizing that the progesterone withdrawal could be increasing the patient's severe COVID disease.
And so briefly, just to make sure I understand, so pregnant mm-hmm. women are more susceptible because of what's happening to them in their bodies at that point. Do we know anything about, did any of this research you find tell you anything about how it can affect the baby?
We did not look at that.
Okay. Dr. Louis, you still deal with patients. And yes. I, first of all, I just want to know, like, since this pandemic started, the types of questions that you've been getting from women, pregnant women, about this virus and, you know, the vaccines. But what do you get? What do you hear?
The most common questions are about whether they are more susceptible to catching COVID or not. I find a lot of people, there's two categories. There's people who underestimate the risks of COVID by a lot. And then there's others who overestimate it, just like the general population. And since the vaccines have come out, the main question is whether or not they should get it.
Yeah. And there's obviously, you know, there are a lot of people who question vaccines when it comes to yes. children. But so what are you getting with that? And I'm wondering, what are you telling them?
Well, I mostly try and focus on individual risk. And, you know, if you're a healthcare worker, you're exposed a lot, and particularly you're exposed, you know, in the intensive care unit or in the hospital setting, you know, places where you're more likely to encounter COVID, you know, a lot of those patients are choosing to go ahead and get vaccinated. And then the rest, I find they just, they fall into different buckets, just depending on their overall feelings about vaccines, how they perceive their own risk, and what they perceive are the unknowns. And based on that, people are choosing all over the place. But what I'm just really glad about is that they have an option and, you know, that they have a choice that they can make for themselves and for their families.
Are there enough studies out there right now on pregnant women, on the impact of COVID on pregnant women, and also again on the fetus?
So we do have, I feel, enough data to say that pregnant women do worse. If you are pregnant and you catch COVID, you're more likely to end up in the intensive care unit. You are more likely to end up on a ventilator. You are more likely to die. Now, having said that, the overall risk of those severe outcomes are low. But if you catch it, yes, you are likely to have worse outcomes. And so that data is very clear.
And what else do we know about how that affects the unborn child?
For the most part, there appears to be very, very low risk of the baby contracting COVID. Most of the cases that are reported where the baby caught COVID were related to the mom being infected at the time when the mom delivered. So that indicates that some of that spread might be happening after the baby was born. So, you know, in other words, not passed while inside the mother, but once the baby's on the outside.
Fascinating. Did not think of that. Again, I'm talking with Dr. Judette Louis. She is the chair of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of South Florida. Also, FIU medical student Allison Roach co-authored a paper on how COVID-19 affects women compared to men and how it affects some women differently depending on where they are in their lives. You can find a link to their work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Allison, you mentioned that going back to the very beginning, women just have stronger immune systems. And again, because of the hormones that we have. But in the analysis, what did you learn about contraceptives and how they might affect the spread of COVID-19 or not?
Yes. So one of the studies that we looked at examined the use of combined oral contraceptive pills in premenopausal patients. And it was a cohort study, and they found that there was a protective effect in symptomatic COVID-19 disease. And so from that study, we were postulating how that could be extrapolated into some of these other patients who could be at high risk. So in our patients who are pregnant, in the postpartum period, if they're at increased risk, we are calling to see if perhaps the use of progestin-only contraceptives in that period might mitigate the severe risk of COVID-19 disease that can be seen in the postpartum period.
All right. And again, I want to clarify too, when I say, I mean, birth control.
Yes, birth control.
Yeah. Dr. Louis, hormonal therapy is personal. It's different for each individual, but is there enough research? You know, would you recommend it for someone to help them fight the worst effects of COVID? Do we know?
We're not there yet. We don't have any information to say to us that supplementing someone with these hormones would actually be beneficial. It's one of the lines of potential investigation for sure, because we are seeing some differences just based on sex and gender.
Yeah. Allison, did I read right in your paper that the most severe cases of COVID-19 in women are happening postpartum?
That is a hypothesis that we drew from some early studies coming from China, which were saying that some of the most severe cases in pregnant patients occurred during the postpartum period. There were also some studies that showed that severe disease occurred in the postpartum period. And that some patients who maybe were asymptomatic but tested positive initially developed symptoms of the disease upon their discharge and delivery of the baby.
Dr. Louis, in your practice, I'm just wondering what kind of concerns do women have after giving birth around COVID-19? Again, what kind of questions are they asking?
Yeah, so often they ask whether they can or should breastfeed or not. They worry about having people come over and visit. You know, when you go home with a new baby, everyone wants to visit, and they may have family members who have very different views about, risk reduction behavior, related to COVID. And so people still want to come visit and things like that. And so we do spend a lot of time addressing how to still maintain social distancing and keep themselves safe from catching COVID in the postpartum period. Because we do know that the postpartum period can be a very vulnerable period for both moms and babies.
And going back to the breastfeeding, what do you tell mothers about that? What do we know?
Oh, absolutely. It is beneficial to breastfeed. Again, very few instances of babies catching COVID from breastfeeding. And in fact, there are some antibodies. If you had COVID, there are some antibodies that can be found in breast milk that may help the baby. You just have to take precautions. We know that COVID gets spread through secretions. And, so the moms can take precautions, wash their hands, wash the breast before breastfeeding, and keep a barrier between themselves and the baby to help prevent, their aerosols and their droplets from their breathing from getting on the baby and potentially infecting the baby.
I'm wondering if you've run into anybody, any mother who just had a baby and then she gets COVID, and what in the world happens then? Because, you know, I know that time that the baby spends with the mother is so important. You got to separate them, don't you?
Well, not necessarily. Initially, in the beginning, a lot of hospitals were separating them, and which didn't make any sense at all, because then they would go home with their child. Mm. So you separated them in the hospital, but not at home. And in fact, we found that it was impacting the ability for the moms to bond with the baby. And so the global recommendation now is not to separate them, but rather to take the necessary precautions to help prevent the babies from getting infected. And then to be to really look out for any signs of irritability or fever that may tell you that the infant is infected.
you know, Dr. Louis, going back, looking at the vaccines that are out there now, the Pfizer and Moderna ones, and they excluded pregnant women or breastfeeding, you know, from their initial clinical trials. So I'm wondering with the data, I mean, what do we know then about how safe it is if they didn't even do that in the trial?
Yeah. So that's a persistent problem. Most of the medications we use in people who are pregnant or lactating are unstudied because they are excluded from clinical trials. Rather, what we usually do is roll it out in the general public. And then when enough people have accidentally used it, we publish that data and say, these people who were pregnant or lactating, you know, this is how they did. And so you get information that way. The problem is that COVID is such a severe disease that that disproportionately affects those who are pregnant in a way that it increased their risk of dying. And so we can't afford to wait for that data. We, from everything that we know in the general public, it has been safe. The COVID vaccines have been safe. We are not seeing large acute effects. And so we know, at least in the short term, that there's safety there. And so I always tell patients they need to weigh their risk of getting COVID and how they'll do during pregnancy versus the risk of what we know about the vaccine so far. And be honest about the fact that there's a lot that we don't know. And for some patients, they view getting the vaccine as their best option.
Are we doing research right now on pregnant women and new mothers with the vaccines as they're rolling out?
Yes. So we do have some data in that Pfizer has started enrolling for their clinical trial using pregnant women. We also have the CDC is collecting data from those who are pregnant and have received the vaccine. Last I heard, there were close to 30,000 individuals in that data, and they indicated that they will publish that at some point, but so far they're not seeing any huge signals or any severe reactions.
Allison, I'm wondering what other research do we need when it comes to COVID-19 effects on women, women in general, or even pregnant women? What's missing?
So one thing that we found that was missing was specific to the polycystic ovarian syndrome patients. They carry a lot of overlap with some of the comorbidities implicated in severe coronavirus disease, such as metabolic syndromes like heart disease, hypertension, obesity, and diabetes. And we want these patients to be seen and studied because they're typically women who are considered young and childbearing age, and most people would presumptively think that they're at decreased risk for disease, but because of the overlap in conditions, we think that they should be monitored more and just really see if there's an association between severe disease and polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Allison, what's next for you in this area? What more study do you need to do in this?
I think we just need to follow the literature and like Dr. Louis is commenting on looking at the vaccine usage in pregnant women and seeing if its effectiveness and safety there. I think that's a really exciting point for us to look at in the future.
It is fascinating research, no doubt. Again, understanding how this virus affects men and women differently, but again, also understanding women go through a lot in their lives that men don't have to, and that puts them in a lot of vulnerable places. And that's good to know. It's good to know what those changes could mean for them, and especially with pregnant women. If you want to know more about the research and what we know so far, again, find us on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to thank my guest, Allison Roach, student at FIU. She's going to be graduating from medical school at FIU this year. Allison, congratulations on that, and thank you so much for the time. Also, Dr. Judette Louis, Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of South Florida. Dr. Louis, thank you for the insight.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Still to come, the Florida legislature begins session in Tallahassee tomorrow. What questions do you have for lawmakers? Call in now, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN, where the legislative session starts in Tallahassee this week with COVID-19 relief, the economic recovery, environmental policy, and so much more on the docket. DeSantis has proposed a nearly $97 billion budget that needs approval by lawmakers. How will the session be different this year with a pandemic? How much can they accomplish? Well, joining us now, two Republican state representatives, Chip LaMarca from Broward County joins us, also Rick Roth from Palm Beach County. Chip, Rick, thank you so much. I appreciate the time, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both. And by the way, if you have a question for them about anything for this session, rest of the hour, we're going to be talking with them. The number's 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Or you can always post your question on our social media, Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Representative LaMarca, I want to start with you. Let's start with COVID-19 relief. The legislature has targeted a couple of specific issues with the state's control. First, I want to ask, what actions are currently underway to address the beleaguered system for filing for unemployment?
Well, that's a great question, Chris. I'm actually honored to be shepherding and carrying the Department of Economic Opportunities agency package for a former colleague and now the director, Dane Eagle of DEO. And there are some fixes in the process, and they're along the way. I don't necessarily want to speak for them, but there are multiple specific issues that really, as you mentioned, made it a beleaguered system, made it a problematic system. But really, the biggest issue was the capacity, the inability to keep up with the capacity. And you have to plan for, you don't plan for, this once in a lifetime on that system. Maybe when you're setting it up, but you probably should. Just like we plan for the 100-year storm in South Florida all the time on the environmental issues. So there's going to be some fixes to making sure that people can, once they're confirmed and they're a legitimate Floridian who's out of work and they've confirmed all those that information, they can move forward and not have to check in quite as much. They can move forward and expect that their payments will be made. Because at the end of the day, this is really an insurance plan that people have paid into through the employer side, and employees, if they're unable to get back to work due to a thing like the pandemic, they should be able to have a system they can rely on. So it's in our hands to do that.
What have you been hearing from your constituents? Are there still people trying to collect their benefits?
My goodness. Yeah. It is a lot better today than it was clearly in the beginning. And as things have tapered off, unemployment is way down compared to where it was before that. But that's not to say that folks who are trying to continue to collect their unemployment benefits, who are still unemployed, maybe with the cruise industry, maybe with other parts of hospitality and tourism, that they're not as important as it was in the beginning. But we are still getting phone calls from constituents, and we're trying to help every one of them as best we can. I'm kind of as you and Representative Roth knows me a little better than anyone else in this call. He and I are both kind of get it done kind of people. We don't necessarily take the social media and call people out. We'd like to get things done and actually get our heads down and get business done. So really, at the end of the day, I think all of our 120 state house offices probably got the same amount of phone calls or the same concern. But we've all been working terribly hard on this, and this is something that's really important.
And what do you say to folks though about the company that was running the platform, Deloitte Consulting, gets mm-hmm. $135 million contract to oversee the Medicaid data? What do you say to voters about that confidence we should have in these systems if they can't, get it right the first time?
Well, there's process and there's politics. And I think when this system was set up, there may have been a little of both in that, and that's unfortunate. It's not necessarily pointing fingers at the company that put it together, but I think the process that brought that system to bear, ultimately, I think where we are now is what I've said to people. I'm not the most tech person you'll find, but I certainly have my nose in it a little bit and do the research enough to know that we have to have a system, an enterprise type system that will scale up and scale back. We don't need the ability to deal with 500,000 or 3 million Floridians on unemployment all the time when we only have 5,000 a week, at one point prior to COVID, but we do need to have a system that can scale up and we can basically turn all the resources on and then dial it back when we don't need to to have that much in place and can save them some money, but certainly we want to have the best of the best for Floridians. They expect that, and that's what we're here to deliver. No matter you know what the situation is. Again, it could be COVID, it could be a downturn in the economy. We need to be there to take care of them.
Yep. Again, I'm talking with Republican State Representatives Chip LaMarca and Rick Roth. If you have any questions, whether it's COVID relief, environmental funding, anything for this upcoming session, which starts tomorrow. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can also call in. Let's hear your questions. 800-743-9576. Representative Roth, one of the key priorities for Republicans is ensuring the passage of liability protections for businesses. What businesses would be included in that?
Thank you for that question, Luis. I think it's all businesses in Florida. We have a real concern as we're trying to be leaders in this state. I got to give high marks to Governor DeSantis, but also give high marks to my Palm Beach County Commission for working with the governor and getting Palm Beach County open as safely and as quickly as possible. And because of that, we identified early on, CFO Petronas came down to West Palm Beach, right down on Clematis Street, downtown City Place, and all that area, and made a big deal about that. And so it's very important for us to move forward and make sure that it's clearly defined how someone would file a liability lawsuit. Because we believe that if the businesses did their job and were doing what they're supposed to do as far as cleanliness, were required to wear a mask, and doing all the protocols, that they would be, they would not be found guilty of a liability lawsuit.
And you know, I'm wondering, what about nursing homes? I mean, you know, there's already for years now we've been having issues making sure that they're meeting, you know, state standards. What about them? What about the liability with them? And what do you say to a family if someone they love is hurt? And it, you know, they're just looking for justice. All right. Well, Representative LaMarca, let me throw that question to you. We may have lost him, but I mean, again, the liability, I understand protecting businesses, but what about nursing homes? What about them? What would you say to that?
Well, I would use Florida as a shining example of, you know, when in comparison to, for example, New York and some other states, we didn't take sick elderly patients and bring them from hospitals in order to clear room in the emergency rooms or the ICUs or any of the hospital beds that were available and put them in nursing homes. And I think, unfortunately, I think we probably saw unnecessary loss of life in a state like New York, whereas in Florida, Governor DeSantis was very specific on, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to treat our seniors, but we're going to leave them in hospitals as we have room. And if we have a shortage of emergency rooms, which we didn't quite get to. I mean, if you think back as the beginning of this, whether it was ventilators or ICUs or emergency room hospital beds and emergency areas of the hospitals, we didn't quite get there. And I think the governor made the right call. You know, there was science behind it. And at the end of the day, some of this might be gut, but I think our governor certainly did the right thing. But you're right. I mean, if somebody's put in a nursing home and gets other members, you know, other residents sick, possibly loss of life, I mean, that's a terrible thing. So I think when we look at liability, we've got to look at, do we do the right things? As Representative Ross said, yes, if your restaurant, for example, and you follow the protocols, you kept your tables distance, you made people wear a mask in between when they're at the table and if they move about the building at all, restroom or anything else, and if you have cleanliness protocols and safety guidelines in effect, I think, you know, that's all someone can do. And being open, being an open state and open business, but being careful, I think is what is going to kind of send us out of the end of COVID like a rocket ship, as opposed to limping out like I think a couple other states will be doing.
I think we have Representative Roth back with us. Sir, are you there?
Yes, sir.
All right. I did want to get your take on this. I mean, I, you know, understand protecting businesses and we got to get back to business. Do you see any situation, though, where, you know, look, with COVID, it's spreading. Anybody could get it. Do you see any situation where perhaps maybe a business should be held liable for it?
Well, yes, it's called limited liability. And that's, to be honest with you, I've read the bill once over. I need to look at it a little bit closer. My understanding is you have to be convincing. You have to, it's a middle standard. It's not the top case or stand your ground case. It's not the same level of preponderance of, I think it's preponderance of evidence. So it's a middle standard, which says you can't just make a claim. You have to have evidence. You got to have more than circumstantial evidence. Nobody is saying that there's no liability. We're saying how that liability needs to be defined. And listen, sir, I've lived in Palm Beach County all my life. I'm 68 years old. Miami used to be known as the whiplash capital. So are there lawyers that are going to try to take advantage of this situation? Of course there are.
Again, I'm talking with the Republican State Representatives Chip LaMarca and Rick Raw, talking about the legislative session. It starts tomorrow. What question do you have? Again, the number is 800-743-9576. Let me go to the phones. I want to go to Michael in Delray. Michael, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Bonnie and Joseph, but you're doing an adequate job. This is for Representative Roth, specifically House Bill 61, which increases the percentage of votes needed to approve an amendment or revision of the Constitution from 60 to 66%. There are a lot of very good citizen-sponsored amendments that have become law. Why do you want to do this? Why don't you leave it at 60%?
All right, I'll let either one of our lawmakers answer that question.
This is Representative Ross Bill.
Yeah, this is my bill, actually.
Go ahead.
This is actually my bill. Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't get your first name, sir. But
Michael.
Michael, thank you so much for the call. And that's obviously appreciate you being so on top of things to ask me that specific question about my bill. Sir, I actually filed that bill for the first time. That was my first bill. My first year in 2017, I think you have to ask yourself the question. We passed a constitutional amendment 2 years ago that said, taxpayers, do you want to protect yourself from the legislature increasing taxes? And they put that in the Constitution saying that it requires a supermajority, two-thirds of the legislature, House and Senate, in order to raise your taxes. So I think it's a U.S. constitutional number, supermajority, to get senators and congressmen to approve a constitutional amendment and then send it out to the states. And I think a supermajority is a good thing to require a supermajority bipartisan to change the Constitution, particularly if you're talking about issues that affect us as legislators being able to balance a budget. That's one of the reasons the economy is doing so well in the state of Florida, is we've had 20 plus years of balancing the budget in a way that has helped businesses grow in the state of Florida. And that's what we want to continue with, is to have a pro-business economy that gives people more opportunities, more freedoms, you know, you could say less lockdown, those type of approaches. So I think it's just a common sense approach that we need to protect our Constitution and defend our Constitution at a time. I think the timing is actually right. I think people are asking, you know, is our Constitution in the United States, is it under attack? I think the time is right.
Yeah, again, that was Michael in Delray. Michael, thank you for the call. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us again on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can always post your question there, and we will read it to either of our lawmakers. Again, talking with the Republican state lawmakers, Chip LaMarca and Rick Roth. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and we're going to talk about the environment as well. That's another big topic that they're going to be dealing with in this upcoming session, which, again, starts tomorrow. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Again, talking about the legislative session, which begins tomorrow in Tallahassee. I'm joined now by Republican State Representatives Chip LaMarca and Rick Roth. And we're taking your calls if you have a question, because, again, we're covering just about any topic. You can always chime in, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. You know what? I wanted to get to the environment, but actually just real quickly, Representative LaMarca, let me start with you on this. We're still in the middle of a pandemic. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what are the protocols when you folks get up to Tallahassee and you start sessions, you start your committee meetings? What are those protocols in place to keep everybody safe?
Yeah, great question. You know, we do our best. My district office is up in my hometown of Lighthouse Point, and you know, we've not stopped, not shut down the office, but we've kept our protocols in place there. But when we come back to Tallahassee every week for committee weeks on Mondays, typically, or if we had to come in a day early, we are required, every member of the legislature and their one immediate staff member who's able to be here in the Capitol, has to go over to one of the office buildings here in the Capitol, and the Department of Emergency Management through ACA and Florida Health Department are doing a full COVID test. And we now have a program called My Healthy Florida. And so we get a shallow test and a deep cleaning. So we get the PCR and we get the rapid, and ultimately we'll get our results back. If there is a positive test within 2 hours, we'll get a text. We'll get a full response back on the app that tells us all of our past positive or negative tests. And that's kind of how we govern ourselves before we can actually get together in the Capitol in the building. Yesterday.
Have there been any talks about getting all lawmakers vaccinated?
Interesting conversation, because, you know, on one hand, clearly that would make sense for lawmakers to be able to be in. You probably still should get a rapid test anyway, but if everyone was vaccinated, we'd probably move about in probably a manner that would be easier once we get in the chambers. But the flip side of that is we'll hear from detractors that would say, well, you're getting some type of special benefit or special favor. And, you know, I was asked by some local operations that were doing it, you know, did I want to put my name on a list of some sort? And I said, no, I'm going to wait until my mother's 76. She got vaccinated. I know my colleague on here is slightly over the age, number. Representative Roth, I want him to get it. I'm gonna make sure I'm as safe as I can, but I'll get it when they lower the age. And so I think you have a good point on all legislators maybe and staff getting it so we can move about. But the governor has a very strong priority of hitting seniors first, and when that comes down, we'll get ours.
Yeah, so we're still at the 65. I know we're moving into the 55 and over soon. All right, let's go to some of the other issues that you guys are going to be tackling. Environment. I want to shift over to the governor. He wants $1 billion in resiliency projects for the state budget, and that includes everything from wastewater treatment to emergency response centers. Representative Roth, what questions do you have about what's included in that proposal?
I had questions in committee. I was very pleased with the second meeting I had with Secretary Valenstein and the Ag and Natural Resources Appropriations, and they had a list of categories. My concern, and I voiced that in my first meeting, my concern is that we take this not slowly, but carefully. I totally agree. I think Representative LaMarca has a Office Resiliency Bill, which I totally support. I was very much in support of the governor when he rolled out the program last year, and we passed a law saying if you spend state dollars on building a building within so many yards of the ocean, that you have to get a sea level rise study done. And you know, we know the sea level in the Miami area has risen a foot in 100 years, and we know that there are places like Miami that are 6 feet above sea level. Fort Lauderdale's 9 feet above sea level. So it's very much something we need to be dealing with. And my hat is off to the governor, but to me, it's an issue of being careful. I think there's actually a bigger concern right now for the state of Florida, and that's just very simple: urban sprawl and population growth. So if the governor Sumner's going to do $1 billion. And by the way, that's a bond. So he's only going to have to come up with $25 million this year and for the next 3 years to bond $1 billion. And that might be the right way to do it because it's a long-term program. But why can't we also do some bonding, $100 million, like the bill I have, to protect our natural resources and our waterways? Because urban sprawl could put a development right in the middle of a pristine area where a spring is, or a pristine area south of Lake Okeechobee where we're concerned about blue-green algae.
Yep.
So I think the governor's on the right track with resiliency, but we also need to be focusing on the more immediate problem, which is conservation of land and protection of our natural resources from pollution. And that's what my constituents in my district are concerned about.
Yeah, and we're seeing that argument here, especially in South Florida, with development pushing into that line when you're talking about the Everglades, across that line, I should say. You know what? The other thing that's interesting, and Representative Lamarck, I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, there's a stark contrast between the Republican leadership now and before. I mean, Governor Rick Scott scraped the word climate change from the state website. Mm-hmm. Now you're talking about $1 billion resiliency plan and a climate change office. And I'm just wondering if this is indicative of the perspective that things have changed. Have we gotten past, you know, this debate about what we're dealing with and we're all on board with protecting the state from this issue?
Well, I'm very proud to be in service in the state of Florida in the legislature, as opposed to where I was in the Broward County Commission at a time where I can work with a Republican governor and legislature and leadership in this legislature, from our speaker all the way down, that this is an issue for them. So the answer to your question is, you know, let's kind of move on from the past. I was always frustrated as a pragmatic conservative serving in city or county government. You know, why are we having the fight and the argument about, you know, what's causing some of these issues with our climate changing and not working on how do we mitigate this? How do we find out how this is going to affect our infrastructure? Let's believe the science from the scientists that aren't politicians and that aren't, prognosticators, and let's just get on with the business. And I think that's kind of to Representative Roth's point, and he's a Florida conservationist conservative, but I would tell you that, you know, as he mentioned the resiliency bill, I think we need to make sure that we have someone that people are comfortable with in the state of Florida. The governor would make that appointment as a chief resiliency officer and chief science officer. And then ultimately, for example, if the task force is passed, I believe that would fold under the good work that was mentioned 2 days ago by Speaker Chris Sprouse and some leadership over in the west coast of Florida. And ultimately, we'll all be on board with what I like to call, you know, the infrastructure projects that will work with our environment. And I think that's really kind of what we're looking at, is these are all a lot of infrastructure projects around the state of Florida that happen to do with sea level issues, hardening our shorelines, renourishing our beaches, making sure our roads are stable and in the area where they can accept some of this water, and then dealing with, like, as Representative Roth mentioned, water quality issues like septic to sewer, and then seawall heights and things like that. If you're going to build, you need to make sure that we're safe from what might happen.
Do you, just out of curiosity, do you find, though, that there is room for compromise? I mean, because you're from Broward, you're a Republican, you know that's a blue area. So, but is there compromise on this issue? Did you find that?
You know what? I think you make a good point where I'm from and what my political affiliation is. But I did serve 8 years on the county commission there, and I was always trying to find out, all right, what's the fiscal impact of our Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact, you know, these issues we want to do, what are those things? And I think why we're where we are now is because organizations like Moody's and S&P have said some things about the viability of, coastal property in the state of Florida. It's a peninsula, obviously.
Yeah.
Or insurance companies saying, hey, maybe we won't write, policies or mortgages that won't go out to 30 years. And so I think this has really become a fiscal, economic, and environmental issue all in one. And people are really kind of understanding, hey, look, we're going to have to answer your question, we're going to have to make some compromises. And I'm willing to sit down and listen and talk to anybody. One of my dear friends on the county commission for my first few years was Representative Kristen Jacobs, who we lost last year. And this was a passion of hers. And I just think that if people sit down, regardless of where you're where you're registered to vote and what your registration is around the state of Florida, I think we can get to a point where we would agree. Let's do the things we all agree on first. And I think some of these issues are pretty agreeable.
Let me get to the phones here before we run out of time. I want to go to Monica, who's been waiting in Miami Beach. Monica, I appreciate your patience. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, guys. I want to thank everyone there for their service and ask why they're trying to change the voting. We finally got it right last time.
Okay. Well, specifically, and if you have something specific that you want to ask them.
Right. The mail-in ballots, they're doing, making it every cycle, and it costs more money. And we finally had it. We were the best nation for our reporting this time. And, you know, in a national election, we did everything right. And now they want to, screw it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why are they doing that?
All right. Let me turn this over to Representative LaMarca or Representative Roth. There has been a question. We've seen this in a lot of states.
I'll go first.
Okay. Representative Roth, go right ahead.
Well, obviously, my good friend Senator Baxley is sponsoring that bill, so I know it's a good bill. I kind of agree with the caller a little bit. I think we have more important issues to deal with. I personally would like to see, rather than us doing having to cert, request an absentee ballot every 2 years. Right now, it's two cycles, which is every 4 years.
Yep.
Rather than do that, I would like to see some different restrictions. I would like to prohibit third-party ballot harvesting. I think if I have a 94-year-old mother-in-law, if my wife should be able to register with the supervisor of elections and be able to deliver that ballot. I think an immediate family member or even a next-door neighbor ought to be able to register. I'm the one that's going to bring in the absentee ballots because maybe somebody doesn't trust the mail and they want to make sure their vote comes in. So I think there's some other things that are more important than that. I'd like to see us require that you actually sign the absentee ballot. Not only do you sign the outside of the envelope, I think you should sign on the ballot itself so we make sure that we can track the ballots properly, particularly when we get so many like we did in the national election.
And Representative LaMarca, the same for you. And I'm just curious, some of the other questions too is about how many days we can early vote and even reducing the number of sites that we can turn in our ballots. What about those questions?
Yeah, great question, and I'm so glad to be on the call. And Monica, thank you for that question, and thank you for saying thank you for your service. I mean, we're not saving the world, and we're not putting our lives in physical danger, but it is a lot of work from our families, and I appreciate you mentioning that. Look, Representative Roth and I are in Palm Beach County and Broward County, and Governor DeSantis had to make a replacement in both of those supervisors of elections, and we were lucky to have someone who in my county came in and gave us a flawless election. Now, it certainly wasn't just Mr. Antonacci, and it wasn't just the supervisor in Palm Beach who ran and is now the elected supervisor. But the fact is, I agree with some of the things that that Representative Ross said, but in Broward, we have the longest early voting process, I believe, in the state. When I was on the commission, and just to remind, I am a Republican, but when I was on the county commission, I voted to pay for the postage so those be mailed back. I think we should make it as easy as humanly possible for every legitimate vote to be cast, whether it's a senior citizen down to a first-time
18-year-old
voter, and I think that should be the case. I mean, we should make sure that's the case and have a system in place. I think what this bill and a lot of these conversations about voting is really that we want to kind of certify what we did and make sure we can do it every time.
Just real quickly, I mean, it seems like, Florida this time, everything went smoothly. There were no problems. We didn't make national news. So if it's, I think as the caller said, it's not broken. Everything seemed to work. Why not leave it as it is?
I actually, to be honest with you, I think some of the things that Governor DeSantis did was actually extending and making it easier to vote in some cases when he extended some time periods. I think as we're having this conversation in the House and the Senate, both political parties and all members will be able to flush this stuff out. But I think what we're really kind of talking about is certifying what we did into, hey, this is how we should do it moving forward. We got it right. Let's do this again.
I have to stop there on time, but I do appreciate the call. Monica, thank you so much for that question. I want to thank my guests, Republican State Representatives Chip LaMarca and Rick Roth. Thank you, gentlemen, so much. And your session begins tomorrow, so you got to get to work.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day.
All right. And again, you can follow everything about the session on our social media at WLRN Sundial. That's our program for this Monday, March 1st. Coming up tomorrow, Muhammad Ali's iconic victory against Sonny Liston in Miami Beach launched him into international spotlight. He spent a lot of time in the Magic City, and there's a new photo exhibit at History Miami Museum about that. We'll tell you more about it. Also, a push to get the unvaccinated in Palm Beach County their doses. All of that coming up on the show tomorrow. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thanks for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.